It's been my pleasure for many years to know this man, who is a fine scholar of literature, American and continental and classical, a man who, with no formal training in the classics, has been drawn to them and drawn himself into them to the point where he feels, and rightly so, that what we find in the classics is always available to all men and women everywhere. That he has made them his province as a not a visitor, not a tourist in the sense that word has derogatory connotations, as an amateur, one who loves literature, one who loves the language, and one whose greatest love is for the telling and the hearing of the stories of our lives. I can think of no better person to open up the two stories we have before us in this session, the story of Joseph and the story of Corianton. So I will let Bruce begin with those stories, and I hope he hurries fast because I have a few things to say at the end. Bruce Jorgensen.
Thank you, Dennis. That's more than I would have expected anyone to introduce me with. I think the metaphor for my relationship to any ancient texts is the stranger at the gate, the guest who hopes to be let in and allowed to get a bath and eat and converse with the household. If you've looked at the program, you already have most of my first paragraph right there, so I can skip that. What I'm going to do is look at two scriptural texts, Old Testament and Book of Mormon, which I think it's fair to suppose are our prime examples for trying to teach chastity, primarily to the young, who seem to need it more than us old people do. Ho, ho. But stories which have seemed to me to have a lot more in them than will be made visible by just talking about them in relation to the law of chastity. Now, I don't intend to defeat their usefulness as moral examples, though I really am going to complicate it. Because the first thing that I have to say is that neither Joseph's story nor Corianton's story is unambiguously or simply a story about keeping or breaking what we now call the law of chastity. Though clearly enough, each story does have something to do with what we call chastity. In the case of Joseph, what we have to notice, first of all, is the terms in which he first refuses Potiphar's wife, her initial plea, or maybe it's a sort of command, lie with me, as the King James Version has it. He says to her, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in this house than I. Neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Undeniably, Joseph regards what she invites him to do as great wickedness that would lead him to sin against God. But Joseph makes no explicit appeal to a code of chastity, at least not to chastity as some sort of personal purity. Though, of course, he may well understand that such a code applies to the act that she has proposed and he's refusing. The wife may not think or admit that it does apply, and his answer to her may show that he knows this by appealing to a code he hopes will matter to her. Notice, then, the grounds he does make explicit. He is a servant or slave, bought, as we've already learned, though he has risen to personal attendant, apparently, verse 4 of chapter 39, he served him, and then overseer, or head slave, top slave. His master has committed all that he hath to Joseph's hand, and has not kept back anything from Joseph but her, because she is his wife. Whether or not he tacitly judges the situation in terms of a chastity code, vocally he judges it in terms of a master-slave relationship and in terms of what things among the master's property have been committed to the slave's hand. Perhaps quite literally, what things he may and may not touch. For a slave to touch property which the master has not committed to the slave's hand may well be, to Joseph, great wickedness and thus a way to sin against God. I believe that in the ancient world such would be the case. The little I know about the ancient gods, the Hellenic ones, because I don't know the Egyptians at all, suggests that one class of things that would offend them would be a servant's disobedience or transgression of the limits of his stewardship under his master. And I'm not aware of any texts predating Joseph that would clarify the Hebrew God's attitude on these matters. The least the text obliges us to say, then, I think, is that though Joseph is young and apparently inexperienced with women, sexually, I assume, but more importantly, morally, logically, and though, as the outcome will show, he is seriously unprepared to deal with this particular woman, Joseph does grasp the situation as something more complex than simply the choice to lie with or not lie with a woman who does not belong to him. He sees the situation as something more or even other than that, a risk of transgressing his status as servant and the limits that places on what he can do with his master's property. He may be wrong, of course, but that would oblige us to show how we know from this text that he is wrong. I think he's at least partly right, though again, he doesn't know enough, isn't shrewd enough to gauge what this woman's response will be, and neither do we, until we put it together when it's too late. The least this text so far obliges us to say about it, as an example of chastity preserved, is that the protagonist grasps his situation in other terms and more complicatedly than we do when we use his story as an example in support of keeping the law of chastity. That might give us pause. It might provoke us to think a little harder about how the scriptures invite us to think about and to act in human situations. What else might give us pause must be that for Joseph, the issue of sexual right and wrong in his situation seems to be an issue of property, of what things are committed to the servant's hand and what things are not. It must at least slightly trouble us that Joseph's speech seems almost to locate the woman among the other things, all that Potiphar hath. Is chastity finally and fundamentally an issue of property? And specifically, an issue of which man a woman is property of, and that's really troublesome. Joseph's speech does, of course, distinguish the woman from the rest of Potiphar's property, singled out as not committed to his hand because thou art his wife. But that will not make either of these questions go away. The woman may be, at most, a special, and in Potiphar's case, since he apparently doesn't keep a harem, maybe a singular kind or item of property. These are questions that I really don't hope to answer, but I can't help raising them because it seems to me Joseph's language raises them. So, again, one implicit point is that the scriptural story, this one at least, looked at a little more closely, gets more complicated than our use of it to illustrate the application of some single moral criterion. Our uses of Joseph's story as a chastity lesson generally, I believe, stop at verse 12, when the young man, the young hero, has fled and got him out. Go ye and do likewise, we tell ourselves and our young people. Though the lessons often go on to suggest that his chastity must be a factor in his later success, a loyalty to God's law that keeps the Lord with Joseph. And that, by the way, is a very important theme in the story, that Yahweh is with Joseph. I didn't think of this in my youth, but lately it has come to seem somewhat ironic that chastity lessons using Joseph don't go on to note the immediate consequence, which might have troubled the young man. His adherence to divine law lands him in jail. Actually, it's a light punishment. He could have been killed if the accusation had fully stuck. It's a puzzle to scholars why Potiphar doesn't, in fact, have him killed. Or to put it in terms closer to those of his own story, which it might be hard for him to ignore, once again, he's stripped and in the pit. The first time it was his brother's envy and resentful anger. This time it's his master's wife's resentful anger. But the ends are much the same. Of course, it takes a while and costs one man's life But Joseph's prison term does lead to his great chance to interpret Pharaoh's dream successfully and thus rise once again, this time to become ruler of the land of Egypt. And Joseph might well regard any hole in the ground that gets him out of the Potiphar household as a step up. But I'm getting ahead of the story at that point. What Robert Alter calls Joseph's long-winded statement of morally aghast refusal has failed, and Potiphar's wife goes on day by day to speak to Joseph, but he hearkened not unto her, to lie by her, or to be with her. Here, hearkened not may recognize an command as well as plea in her bluntly reiterated, lie with me. That way of putting it, by the way, might be a Jacobean translator's euphemism, as the Revised English Bible's come make love to me seems a modern euphemism for the Jacobean one. A contemporary seductress might try to put the point across minimalistically with just two words of one syllable. The shift from her lie with to the narrator's lie by may suggest the kinds of occasions he avoided once warned by that first request, reclining by her near her for meals or conversation, when she might have asked for the pleasure of his company. For be with her, the Revised English Bible reads, be in her company. At any rate, given a favorable opportunity, when Joseph, instead of avoiding her, went into the house to do his business or his work or his duty, and there was none of the men of the house there within, she tries one last time. The empty house seems almost to fulfill Joseph's earlier words, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and she seizes the moment by laying a hand on the master's property, or almost. She caught him by his garment, saying, lie with me. The gestures that accompany her lie with me, here and earlier, seem intended to contrast sharply. The first time she cast her eyes on Joseph, here there is no look, no possible meeting of the eyes, only grabbing, and we may accordingly hear lie with me in quite different tones. In fact, the Hebrew literally there, cast her eyes on, is lifted her eyes unto, or raised her eyes to, which one commentator rejects rendering literally because he says it usually implies trust. Now I think, of course, yes, yeah, that would make perfect sense. Why not use the literal? And at many points here where I've been able to check Hebrew commentaries, I haven't a word of Hebrew myself. Whenever a commentator has indicated the literal, I've said, well, why not? Let's use the literal. You'll see some of these coming up later on. Garment here seems to be a sort of general term for a Hebrew word the translators can't render more specifically. It may just mean that he's wearing only one garment, as in fact von Rad asserts, stripped to this undershirt sort of thing, or the Revised English Bible calls it a loincloth. The point is that he has only one garment on. His business in the house has overridden Joseph's erstwhile caution, and he's now caught. Faced with the violation of chastity, or of his servant status, or of his master's property, both himself and the woman, Joseph does the only thing he can do. He left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. Apparently, she won't let go. If she can't lie with him, she'll look. And he's not going to stay for tug-of-war. He'll cut and run. Maybe he recognizes even that won't save him entirely. He seems not to suspect just how much hell will break loose. Left holding his empty garment, she swiftly calls the men of her house and accuses Joseph to them in a scene which Joseph cannot have witnessed, though he might have pieced it together later from servants' gossip, and which the writer, therefore, I think, has clearly constructed for our benefit. Mainly the wife just bears false witness of what we've been told actually happened. He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried with a loud voice. And it came to pass when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. She falsifies Joseph's reason for coming into the house, imputes her sexual intention to him, and claims to have responded before Joseph fled, as a dutiful wife and chaste woman should, by crying with a loud voice. They did hear her, did they not? So what took them so long to answer? There is some risk here that one or more of these servants might have seen Joseph entering the house clothed and fleeing it naked before they heard her outcry. Still, I doubt these men of her house would have questioned her claim, since the phrase that refers to them suggests that they are slaves committed to the house, though raises other small questions. Is she here thinking of the house as her house? After all, she is the wife. Or does she have a separate dwelling on the estate? If so, did her climactic lunge at Joseph occur there? If so, what was his business there? Or, as I think more likely, was she lying in wait for Joseph in the house, the main house or master's dwelling? And does that explain why the men of her house were not immediately at hand and had to be called unto? Obviously, they were within hearing and did hear the outcry she raised, so it's clear she's willing to risk this circumstantial lie with them. Perhaps she's sure they would not dare speak against her. She does, after all, have some power in her house. Whatever Joseph may think about, none greater in this house than I. And power, specifically the sexual power politics of the Potiphar household, now begins to look like the main issue for the wife, though Joseph seems not to have had a clue. For just as this entire small scene must seem in excess of a simple chastity lesson, and I think that's why it's generally ignored, certainly not read closely in church instruction. So the first part of the wife's accusation to the men of her house looks oddly in excess of her situation. See, she says, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. What's going on here in this part of the story that Joseph, who got him out, can't know, unless it's reported to him later? Whatever we may want to make of Joseph's heroic youthful chastity, and there's no question that he has preserved his chastity in this episode, whatever his conscious motives were, the teller of the tale has other fish to fry. Here, it's at least the situation and psychology of the villainess of the piece, one of our culture's favorite bad women, the arch seductress. And beyond that, as I've suggested, the sexual politics of Potiphar's house. The wife, though Joseph may never know it, turns out to be much more than the simple, generic sexual temptation she is in our instructive uses of the episode. More than either Joseph or we could guess from her repeated imperative, lie with me. What she reveals of her mind after the fact, we are invited now to read back into the earlier scenes of the episode, tangled with what had seemed a simple, if obdurate, case of predatory female lust. See, he hath brought in an Hebrew unto us to mock us. She first accuses Potiphar of intending to mock us by bringing Joseph into the house. Does her us mean herself and the men of her house as Egyptians, hence her stress on an Hebrew, or as possessions of Potiphar, his slaves and his wife, over whom this Hebrew has been lifted? As Joseph all innocently reminded her in his first refusal, he hath committed all that he hath to my hand, there is none greater in this house than I. Well, why not both? And in reaction to this, as much as to Joseph's sexual refusal, she shows herself as what hell hath no fury like. Yet not quite so frankly to Potiphar. When Joseph's and her lord came home, she revises the first part of her accusation to fit this face-to-face confrontation with the master of the house. The Hebrew servant, which thou hast brought unto us, came in unto me to mock me. The rest, somewhat condensed and slanted, is the same deposition she made to her servants. As to them, she stresses to Potiphar Joseph's alien origin, Hebrew, but now adds a stress on his status, servant. She's speaking now to the master, not to other slaves. And she may wish to hint that no servant should be greater in this house than the master's wife. She seems to weigh Joseph's Hebrew servant status in to increase her offense, the offense to her own status as Egyptian wife. And her words for the offense, to mock me, displace and shift the meaning of the word mock. To the servant, she claimed, Joseph came in unto me to lie with me. But to the master, she presents herself as a dutiful wife, too chaste to mention sexual matters directly. To the servants, her word mock referred mainly to the offense of an Hebrew being placed above all others in this Egyptian household. But to her husband, the word must do duty for the sexual offense a good wife cannot bring herself to name directly, though that offense is also against her dual status as Egyptian and wife, suggesting an aristocratic attitude that a slave's sexual approach to the master's wife insults her status. Last in this speech, mock cannot directly accuse Potiphar of intending to scorn her and the rest of the household, so her sentence makes came in unto me to mock me a sequel or result of thou hast brought unto us. The accusation of Potiphar still hovers here, implicit in this hinted causality, but it will have to be his interpretation, not her declaration. She knows how far she can't afford to go, and she shrewdly curbs her resentment toward her lord and master. In the one more line we hear of her voice, the last we shall ever hear of her, an indirect discourse echo displaying Potiphar's grasp of her accusation, perhaps she pushes that limit a bit more insistently. When his master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, after this manner did thy servant to me. It's the emphasis on the word thy, which is a new element here. Her furious but crafty little script works. His wrath was kindled against his servant for precisely the breaches of high trust and exclusive property that Joseph had futilely warned of when the wife first approached him. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison. The wife's one possible accuser is out of the way, and presumably she has saved her own status in the household. Well, we're going to learn no more about the marriage or the later careers of the Potiphars. I can imagine a British TV series about this. But if we've paid attention to some earlier clues, we can venture to guess a little further as to just how and why the wife felt mocked by Potiphar and Joseph. At the first mention of Potiphar in the Joseph story, we are told that the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and captain of the guard. Thus the Jacobean translation reads. But the current LDS edition glosses this verse, officer, translates Hebrew eunuch, which often designates a royal official. And the Bible dictionary in current LDS editions defines eunuch as a class of emasculated men attached to the courts of eastern rulers. They were employed to watch over the harems and also were often given positions as trusted officials. Commentators note the literal sense of the Hebrew word, yet seem reluctant to take it literally. But why not take it so? The sequence of titles identifying Potiphar then may actually condense his history. A eunuch, castrated so he would pose no threat to the royal wives or the royal bloodline, he's been elevated to a guard's captaincy, which the current LDS edition glosses with Hebrew, chief of the butchers, or the cooks, probably the chief steward. That's a favorable reading, especially in view of the later statement that he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he knew not aught he had save the bread which he did eat. This might refer mainly to ritual cleanliness. Egyptians apparently don't eat with Hebrews and don't let Hebrews handle their food. Yet it could as well suggest a character trait, an apt man for the job of chief butcher or cook, or maybe the job reduced or magnified him to fit it. Potiphar appears to be mainly a glutton with no interest in more than his appetite for food. As eunuch, he's presumably uninterested in or at least incapable of sex. He has a wife, but she's a sort of ornament, like a badge or some item of full-dress uniform, little more, as a court official, he probably needs a wife for state functions or something, reasons of protocol. That's my unlearned man's guess about that, just taking the words literally here. Well, anyway, further, as a glutton or gourmand who's really interested in food, Potiphar likely has even less sex appeal than he might have as a lean and healthy eunuch. No wonder the wife is a furious woman. Like it or not, she's little more than an object in the house, possibly surrounded by eunuchs of her own. And then the master brings in this young Hebrew slave, who sheds prosperity on everything he touches, so that Potiphar takes a fancy to him and makes him his personal attendant, and then overseer of all the other slaves. Above all, having inherited his master's beauty, young Joseph is a goodly person and well-favored. Small wonder that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, lie with me. She's sexually neglected and resentful already mocked, structurally if not emotionally, by her marriage and now by the presence of this healthy and virile servant who is not hers to command and who has in fact risen to a status that rivals or exceeds her own and who, as a male and an overseer, would seem to have more sexual opportunity than she has. Would it even occur to her that Joseph might have any commitment to a code of chastity? I don't have any way of even answering that question. She is in a position to envy Joseph both in himself and as her master's personal attendant. The whole situation, then, is a layered and highly charged triangle well before her first speech. No wonder at all, then, that Joseph's first refusal, couched in terms of servant status and property, and showing a clear grasp of those components of his situation, but complete naivete about the wife's quite different relation to those same factors, would begin to heat her ire more than cool her lust. And small wonder that his protracted day-by-day avoidance and climactic flight would boil that resentment into fury. On the face of the narrative, Joseph seems hardly to have a clue to just how complex, especially how bound up with resentment and violence, the wife's so directly expressed and seemingly simple lust is. The clues he does have, he first tries to use to deflect her, but they don't work because they refer to the very structure of status and property that arouses her violent lust. And his last desperate recourse, to leave his garment in her hand and flee and get him out, at once sexually rejecting her and insulting and jeopardizing her status, burns out her lust and leaves her anger blazing. His flight does preserve his chastity, though it preserves nothing else he might have wanted to preserve. The left garment and Joseph's nakedness may, if we wish, symbolize the status he has lost, top slave, and the identity he has saved. Simple Joseph, clean and bare, falling again yet bound to rise. The overall story here is, of course, a grand comedy. It is a story in which chastity, right or wrong sexual choice, plays a part. Yet when we read it more closely, the issues the story foregrounds in its language will make it hard to read so simply in terms of that single issue. We may take it up, as we like or need, into the simplifying mode of moral exhortation, but both the protagonist and the teller of the tale rather clearly grasp the story in more complicated, less easily reduced ways than that. If we try to take it up in their ways, then, what does it tell us about chastity and how to keep it? Maybe less than we would like to know, and more than we suppose the youth need to know. This, at least, that no human moral situation or act is ever quite so simple as its description in terms of any single moral rule, although to act in such a situation from fidelity to any single moral rule, whatever rule we think applies, may well save something worth saving. And that we can never determine all the consequences of our acts, right or wrong. But that is in God's hands anyway. After all that density and puzzlement and complexity, you may find yourself spelling relief as I turn to Corianton. Here at last will be plainness, a flat-out declaration that sexual sin is next to murder. Alas, though that idea has the status of church doctrine, Alma 39:5 does not simply and unambiguously yield a proof text for it. I'm really sorry to bear bad news if this is bad news, but I didn't write the news, and I only know what I think I read on the pages. I do accept the doctrine, promulgated in the 1942 First Presidency Statement, and often reaffirmed since, and I think often declared before 1942 as well. But Alma's words to Corianton are simply not that specific, and in fact leave us enough room to wonder and guess that we may well need prophetic specification of Alma's meaning. Here's how Alma's rebuke goes, quite specifically. Thou didst do that which was grievous unto me, for thou didst forsake the ministry and did go over into the land of Siron among the borders of the Lamanites after the harlot Isabel. Yea, she did steal away the hearts of many. But this was no excuse for thee, my son. Thou shouldst have tended to the ministry wherewith thou wast entrusted. Then, to reinforce the gravity of that which was grievous unto me, he generalizes. Know ye not, my son, that these things are an abomination in the sight of the Lord? Yea, most abominable above all sins, save it be the shedding of innocent blood or denying the Holy Ghost. That's a troublesome proof text. And the first trouble is the plural, these things. In this immediate context, Alma is not speaking only of chasing a harlot. So what else is next to murder? Still, the generalized plural doesn't exclude sexual sin, and in fact allows plenty of room for that specification. But now the next trouble arises. What sexual sin has Alma accused Corianton of? Thereby should have hung a tale, but it's a tale we have not been told and will not be told in the Book of Mormon as we have it. So we have to infer it as cautiously and justly as we can from the words Alma said to his son. We hear only one side of a conversation, or we read a closet drama for two actors with all the speeches of the second actor excised. We're on the verge, then, of yet more narrative interpretive difficulty, doubled by our having to try to trace what we can of the story through its refraction in the sentences of a quite different kind of discourse, a sustained moral exhortation and doctrinal exposition that comprises four chapters of the text. I'm going to stick with chapter 39 fairly strongly. This does prompt a digression. Some LDS scriptural commentators sometimes acclaim the doctrinal expositional plainness of Latter-day Scripture as preferable to the frequent difficulty and sometimes downright narrative or poetic obscurity of the Old and even the New Testament. Partly as if we were to be congratulated for having outgrown a need or taste for complex narratives about complex human actions, for having grown into a capacity to take our doctrine, as if that were all we needed, in doses of straight exposition, without the admixture of sweet or sour story or the thin candy coating of superb prose or poetic style. But I'm not so sure the expositional mode of the Doctrine and Covenants or the prominence of exposition even within the narrative structure and continuity of the Book of Mormon is a complement to our intellectual maturity so much as a concession to our loss of narrative intelligence or our suspicion of complex stories. The Book of Mormon, though an ancient record, was finally, when the people to whom it belonged as a cultural tradition had set about destroying themselves, written for our day. And the redactor, Mormon, whose severe abridgment we have been given, may have seen that we would no longer be capable of receiving human or divine wisdom told in stories. We don't have the whole contents of the Nephite plates, perhaps especially the more history part, or the more particular part of the history, because we're not ready to read them in more ways than one. To use Corianton as a bad example, a violator of the law of chastity, it would be nice to have his more particular history, so we might see more clearly how he sinned, how he came to sin, and how he repented and went on to serve after his father's exhortation. We can only guess at the story's general outline and at some of its inner dimensions of motive and self-deception and self-justification. Yet even such faint tracings may yield us a Corianton who, like his long-ago kinsman Joseph, turns out to be a more complicated example than we had thought. How did Corianton sin? More ways than one, if we trust his father's plural words, things, and later, crimes. And maybe not in the specific sexual way we have supposed, again, if we trust the words Alma does say and don't presume too far on his silences. Alma charges Corianton particularly with going on unto boasting in thy strength and thy wisdom, with having forsaken the ministry to go after the harlot Isabel, with having gone after the lusts of your eyes, with having suffered himself to be led away by a vain or foolish thing, and having suffered the devil to lead away his heart after those wicked harlots, and last, with having brought great iniquity upon the Zoramites, for when they saw your conduct, they would not believe in my words. Except for a later charge of offense upon points of doctrine, which I believe Corianton incurs by questioning a point in Alma's counsel, 41, 9, and 10. As far as I can tell, that's the complete list, and its half dozen particulars do justify Alma's use of the plurals, these things, and your crimes. Yet nowhere, in what looks like an attempt to be quite particular about those crimes, does Alma specifically charge Corianton with the sin our chastity lessons usually accuse and convict him of without a hearing, fornication. Why not? Perhaps Alma has a compunction about using specifically sexual terms. But it's hard to believe this of Alma, who otherwise seems to mince no words in his forthright denunciation of his wayward son. Perhaps, even so, he wants to spare his son's feelings at least a little bit. After all, he does say, I would not dwell upon your crimes to harrow up your soul if it were not for your good. Maybe plainly naming a sexual sin would dwell too heavily or harrow too fine and deep, though we might think otherwise. Or maybe Alma does not know whether Corianton fornicated or not, and thus stays scrupulously within the limits of what he does know. Corianton did go after the harlot Isabel, or after those wicked harlots. This much the Zoramites saw and took as an occasion to ignore Alma's preaching, and the rest must be conjecture and a decent silence which waits for Corianton's full confession. That would be another more particular part of his history that our abridgment does not tell us. Maybe it's all right for us to suppose what we will, as long as we don't mind being in the morally awkward position of accusing Corianton of more than his father does, accusing possibly innocent blood. I do mind. I think the most severe reading I can let myself give this passage is that Alma does make exactly the accusations he has grounds for making, justice exercising all his demands, and declines to make any others. As to whether Corianton did or did not fornicate, or did or did not confess having done so, Alma and the text are strictly silent. And our judgment or our suspicion reflects more on us than on his sinning son. That may be may even be one of the reasons the text is constructed just as it is, to oblige us to confront our own suspicions and decisions in the absence of complete evidence, and to judge ourselves in the light of the judgment we meet. Also, to oblige us to identify with a father and priesthood leader in this specific situation of judging and counseling an errant son. We do well, then, to judge mercifully, as we would be judged, and as I believe Alma, for all his severity, does judge his son, whom he loves and will not disown. Over and over he repeats, "My son," 10 times in chapter 39 alone, half of those in verses 3 through 9, confirming their inextricable bond, claiming the young man, as he later tells him, "Mercy claimeth all, which is her own." That must matter as much as anything else he has to say to him. That might be another thing worth learning from this episode, worth more perhaps than learning which sin or sins may be abominable above all sins, save it be the shedding of innocent blood or denying the Holy Ghost. Thus far, I've deferred the possibly sexual phrase, "lusts of your eyes," partly because if it does signify sexual sin, it signifies something less than fornication, and partly because it's a problematic term that need not have a specifically sexual connotation. The 1828 Webster's Dictionary explains that the primary sense of the term lust is to extend, reach, expand, to stretch forward. It is the same as list, as in whom ye list to obey. And then it cites three current senses and one not used. First, longing desire, eagerness to possess or enjoy. Second, concupiscence, carnal appetite, unlawful desire of carnal pleasure. Third, evil propensity, depraved affections and desires. And fourth, obsolete, vigor, active power. Current LDS Bibles do not gloss lust of the eyes, where it occurs in 1 John 2:16 as one term of a triad summing up all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, and condemning these as not of the Father but of the world. Lust of the flesh there in John's epistle does sound like sexual lust. But then does lust of the eyes simply collapse into that as one more manifestation of the same desire, or is it a distinct mode of desire or pleasure? I think the terms in John's triad name distinct though related modes of secularity that turn or list from God. That would make lust of the eyes sinful enough, though not sexual in our sense. For St. Augustine, who adopted the triad from John's epistle as the partial basis of a rigorous self-examination in Confessions, Book 10, chapters 30 to 36, concupiscence of the eyes, which he saw as rooted in the appetite for knowledge, meant an attachment to corporeal or natural beauties and to the very corporeal light by which they shine, and a sort of visual curiosity which could swell into a reckless desire for novelty or experience for its own sake. In either sense, that would be sinful enough for Augustine, since it would distract the soul from fixing its desire purely on God. But lust of the eyes is not a sexual lust for Augustine. For him, both are at the root forms of misdirected human desire as such, which does not know that its ultimate and only true object is God. His examples of this lust include having his eye caught by a hare running across a field or by a spider spinning a web. Well before the 19th century, as a survey of the senses of the term in the OED will quickly show, lust in England had acquired its specific and strongly pejorative sense of sexual appetite or desire, chiefly and now, that's 1878 to 1928 when the OED was being compiled and published, exclusively implying intense moral reprobation. Yet it still retained its equally well-established biblical and theological use, signifying sensuous appetite or desire considered as sinful or leading to sin. And in this sense was often used in the plural, especially in lusts of the flesh or fleshly lusts. This restates the ambiguity, then. A potent sense of the term beginning to stain all its other uses by Joseph Smith's time. Lust of the eyes might be mainly sensuous, but it might also be sexual. And to translate Alma's language with the plural lusts of your eyes might be unusual, but not unprecedented in the English religious vocabulary available to Joseph Smith. It could suggest multiple and different kinds of objects of visual desire or pleasure. In more than 40 years of regular activity in the church, I can't recall hearing the phrase lust of your eyes used in any warning against sin, unless it was quoted and not discussed from 1 John. Not even in condemnations of film and television, which Augustine would have seized upon gleefully, I think, along with tourism, as evidence that our generation was wholly swallowed up in this sin. And he'd have loved to pun on the Latin video, I see. Yet Alma includes it in a list of things most abominable, in which he sternly warns Corianton to cross yourself, for except you do this, you can in no wise inherit the kingdom of God. So the trouble is thicker than ever. Not only do we not find Alma specifically and unambiguously chastising Corianton for any obvious sexual sin like fornication, but we find him excoriating a visual sin that we hardly bother to think about, which even he may regard as a vain and foolish thing, empty and trivial. And even if we take lust of the eyes as a sexual sin, applying Jesus' declaration that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery with her already in his heart, all that does is widen the already plural category and catalog of next-to-murder sins to a rather burdensome breadth. And if thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out. Those are hard sayings, but they've been said. And so far, this is the news I can read on the pages. The little I understand of Alma's exhortation thus far, and the little less I understand of Corianton, and how he sinned so grievously as to call down this severe warning from his father and spiritual leader in the mission to the Zoramites. Again, as with the Potiphar episode, the least the text obliges us to acknowledge if we read it a little more closely is that, as an example for our chastity lessons, so far it is distressingly nonspecific or puzzlingly overprecise about sexual sin. And worse, it stubbornly resists any attempt to reduce it so as to illustrate the application of a single, simple moral rule. Like Joseph and the teller of Joseph's tale, Alma is less simple than our lessons would have him be. He insists on complexly grasping a complex human reality which he knows intimately, but does not claim to know totally. And unlike the teller of Joseph's tale, Alma, or Mormon editing and abridging him, does not tell us a story. He exhorts and expounds. But in that exhortation and exposition, he does implicitly analyze. And what he analyzes, not totally, not exhaustively, is the soul of Corianton. It performs a kind of psychology. And I'll try to trace this briefly. I'm going to hurry up because I need to give Dennis a little chance to respond. Okay, first he says that Corianton did not give so much heed unto my words as did thy brother among the people of the Zoramites. Corianton might have taken his older brother Shiblon as an example of attentive obedience to his father's words, and that would have been a good example to the Zoramites. But perhaps caught up in the novelty of being among a foreign people in a foreign place, he did not. And more crucially, thou didst go on unto boasting in thy strength and thy wisdom. Corianton had too much self-esteem. He was too self-reliant. Next, he forsook the ministry and followed the harlot Isabel over into the land of Sihon among the borders of the Lamanites. That is, he pursued novelty or strangeness into farther reaches, geographically, culturally, socially, and perhaps sexually. Since Alma cites this adventure after citing Corianton's excessive self-reliance, we may suppose that excessive self-reliance allowed him to believe he could take these risks without seriously endangering his soul or anyone else's. And besides, we can imagine him saying in the silence after his father names Isabel, he wasn't the only one who found her attractive. Yes, I know, we can imagine his father answering, she did steal away the hearts of many, but this was no excuse for thee, my son. Meaning either that he cannot justify his bad example by appealing to anyone else's, so much for self-reliance, or that Alma strongly doubts he bothered to make that excuse for himself when he forsook the ministry. The phrase, steal away the hearts, sounds like a cliche of junk romantic fiction, and that may have been its provenance in the vocabulary of Joseph Smith, but it translates a fatherly concern of the highest order. The heart is at stake here, the seat of thought, desire, and volition in biblical usage. And to Alma, Corianton's rash act seems to have suggested his heart had grievously strayed from the ministry it was called to, and for a vain and foolish thing at that. Suffer not the devil to lead away your heart again. Corianton's salvation hangs in the balance, not yet for any specific and acted sexual sin, unless lust of the eyes, but, as it would in Augustine's moral theology, for a sinful misdirection of the heart away from God, from God's work, and from God's words, as given through his father and mission leader. The harlot Isabel may well have been a highly paid and notorious courtesan, quite beyond Corianton's means, who might not even have given this young foreigner a second glance. She may not even have guessed all this was happening, may not have flung any specific seductive looks or charms wittingly at the boy's eyes. She need have been little more than the occasion for his error, a hare running across his path. I can guess a little farther here, though I'll try to undercut some of my guesses. Though Alma need not know or suspect this, Corianton might have been telling himself, boasting in his own strength and wisdom, rather than trusting his father and God and staying where he was called among the Zoramites, that he the harlot and her entourage, not to mention a few Cyrenites and Lamanites. But that was not his business, and his father tells him so. Thou shouldst have tended to the ministry wherewith thou wast entrusted. That's conjecture, and it's plausible, but it isn't conclusively arguable. Less conjectural might be the hunch that the plural lusts of his eyes, including but not limited to sexual curiosity, were what led Corianton across the borders, no matter what higher motives he may have boasted to himself. Why else would Alma make so much of that vain and foolish thing, warning Corianton in words that echo his earlier "go after the harlot," "go no more after the lusts of your eyes, but cross yourself in all these things." Again, the plurals invite or allow us to suppose that more than sexual temptation was involved, though we can also, if we wish, take all these things as referring to any and all forms of sexual temptation. That works all right in this one verse, but in the fuller context of the chapter, he tried to show that. It just ignores all the other items in Alma's list. Okay, this about sums up what I see Alma saying about the etiology of Corianton's sin, how it got going. He has not, so far, described the young man as a fornicator, but only as a brash and rash youth who overreached himself, transgressed some borders for vain and foolish reasons he probably hid from himself under a varnish of high-minded self-esteem. So doing, Corianton surely did put himself in the way of serious sexual temptation and transgression. That's a harlot's stock in trade. Though harlots have been known to repent, and Jesus once declared they would go into the kingdom of God before the chief priests and elders. I think Corianton's lust, and it would be naive to suppose he doesn't have any, amounted more to curiosity than sexual passion. As many of us could testify, is largely true of adolescent lust. That doesn't make it any less dangerous, it just indicates it's a vain and foolish thing. And I think that Alma sees him this way and swiftly, justly, and mercifully seeks a means to prevent worse damage than Corianton has already done to himself and others. For me, this makes Corianton almost useless as a clear example of unchastity and what to do about it, but a much more interesting and complexly understood case of a sinful action, partly driven by incipient unchastity, that involves the full dimensions of a complicated human psyche, including the intellectual or doctrinal points that worried Corianton's mind, which I'm not going to go into. But Alma's implicit analysis doesn't limit itself to etiology or even symptomatology. His diagnosis of Corianton's sin goes well beyond the direction of the youth's heart and his wanderings into strange territory, into the effects that straying had on others, whom Corianton seems not to have given a thought, the Zoramites. "Behold, O my son, how great iniquity you brought upon the Zoramites, for when they saw your conduct, they would not believe in my words. And now the Spirit of the Lord does say unto me, command thy children to do good, lest they lead away the hearts of many people to destruction. Therefore I command you, my son, in the fear of God, that ye refrain from your iniquities, that ye turn to the Lord with all your might, mind, and strength, that ye lead away the hearts of no more to do wickedly, but rather return unto them, and acknowledge your faults and that wrong which ye have done." Here I suggest we do approach a consequence of sin, a burden that will be upon Corianton's soul because he was called to the ministry, that we can take seriously as next to murder, near to the shedding of innocent blood. Corianton's bad conduct, forsaking the ministry and running off to the borders, has made him, like the harlot and like the devil, one who leads away the hearts of many people to destruction. Spiritually, this is near to murder, for murder takes away the life of the body and cuts short the space for repentance God grants every soul in the world. And this leading by bad conduct does delay and may prevent the repentance of those whose hearts are led away. They would not believe in my words. The Spirit's dramatic intrusion into Alma's discourse at this point seems to confirm that this is indeed the heart of the matter. Command thy children to do good, lest they lead away the hearts of many. This leading away, I'm nearly done, is a sin Alma has good cause to comprehend and abhor as grievous, for he committed it in his own young manhood, as we know, having read that story twice before we reach this point. Once in the third person, Mosiah 27, and once in the first person, when Alma tells the story to Helaman, Alma 36, not long before this exhortation to Coriantum. The language of both those accounts of Alma's youthful sin strikingly anticipates the language he uses with Coriantum. To cite only three instances, in Mosiah 27, the account says that Alma became a great hindrance to the prosperity of the church, stealing away the hearts of the people. The confessional account to Helaman admits, "Yea, and I had murdered many of his children, or rather led them away into destruction," and says that during Alma's 3 days and nights of paralyzed insensibility, his soul was harrowed up to the greatest degree. Can we doubt, then, that to Alma, the sin next to murder is anything, self-esteem, unchastity, anger, riches, or any vain or foolish thing by which I let my heart be led, or by which I lead the heart of another away from God? All sins for Alma seem to be ultimately forms of idolatry, whoring after strange gods rather than loving and being faithful to the God who knows us. During his torment for his sin, Alma knew the pains of a damned soul, eternal torment, and the pains of hell, or of living without God in the world, so acutely that he longed to become extinct both soul and body. That, he seems to feel, is the ultimate description of those whose hearts are distracted or led away from God, and that, I think, is his understanding of sin, not simply as rule-breaking, but as fundamental action and condition. Again, we can, if we wish or need, use Alma's exhortation to Coriantum to support a chastity lesson. For chastity, or at least the risk of risking chastity, is an issue in it. But even its first chapter presents us with an insistently larger and more complicated case than that. Like the teller of Joseph's tale, Alma, and Mormon abridging him, has other and bigger fish to fry. Alma's grip on the root nature of sin is every bit as profound and severe as Augustine's, and his analysis of Coriantum's sin, searching its dark and tangled ways in the psyche of his son, declines to reduce its human, moral, and spiritual complexity to the simple keeping or breaking of any one moral rule. I've got three more pages, but I want Dennis to respond. Thanks.
Session isn't doing here for 15 more minutes. So I'm going to take about 5 minutes and then open it up for questions. And I hope you have some of Bruce. I have many. But rather than follow those questions, I will start, as I always start in these matters, with a pun. I decided to call my response "The Chaste and the Pursued." A measured response rather than a response incommensurate with Bruce's own careful reading. Let me assert that the stories that Dr. J asks us to look at are success stories. In their present form, stories which help define the good life that allows one to repay his obligations to his society. I base that assertion on their context and the circumstances of their transmission to us. You all know well the story of the writing of Mormon's book, from having read it, from having heard it. Moses' book was composed in similar circumstances. As it stands, according to the best scholarship now applied to it, the book of Genesis is held to be a composite narrative. There are four strands of writing. These strands include Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, as we call them. The fifth of the books of Moses, Deuteronomy, is the work of yet another writer. So we have, in what we call the books of Moses, at least five writers. They're known as J for the writer who writes using the name Yahweh for God, which used to be transliterated following the Latin as Jehovah, not a correct transliteration of the Hebrew. Yahweh is a guess at the vowel sounds, but J speaks of God as Yahweh. The Eloist, or E, speaks of God as Elohim. A third writer, the priestly writer, or P, also speaks of God as Elohim, but is very concerned with the function of priests in society. And the fourth writer is the redactor, or R. Bruce referred to these in his notes and in his asides and parenthetical comments, most of which he did not read. The oldest of the four strands of narrative is the J story. And I want to read to you the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife as it stands in a translation presented as the Book of J, the work of David Rosenberg, with commentary by Harold Bloom, a book that's been quite controversial, but for good reason. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, where an Egyptian bought him from Ishmaelites, out of the hands of those who brought him down. So it was. Yahweh attended Joseph, and so it happened that Joseph grew prosperous. Now look, he is in the house of his Egyptian lord. His lord could see that Yahweh attended Joseph, in whose hands everything that he tended matured. Joseph warmed his heart. He appointed him personal attendant, head of his household, and all that he had was put into his hand. So it was. Yahweh blessed the Egyptian's house on behalf of Joseph, from the time he became head over the household and all the holdings. So it happens. Yahweh's blessing covers all that he holds, in the house, in the field. With everything committed to Joseph's hands, the Egyptian restrains his concern about almost anything, except the bread he ate. Now look, Joseph is a finely formed man, a handsome vision. It happened that his master's wife, a good time later, beckoning Joseph with her eyes, whispered, "Recline by me." He abruptly declines. "Look, my lord counts on me," he says to the lord's wife, "to handle the house. He has left everything in my hands, stands no watch over me. I am not restrained from anything but yourself, since you are his wife. How could I commit this height of offense and show contempt for the gods?" So it was. She would appeal to Joseph day after day, yet he declined her desire that he lie with her, attend her. On one of these days, as he enters the house to work, he passes no servants, finds none in the room. Now she grasps hold of his coat. "Recline by me." But he abandons the coat in her hand, flees, runs outside. As she stood there, empty coat in her hand, seeing he had run away, she screamed for the servants, "See how he has brought us a Hebrew man to handle us. He entered the room to lie with me, but I started to scream, and look, he realized I would not restrain myself and ran outside, left his coat in my hands." Now the coat lay beside her until Joseph's master came home. These were her words to him. "That Hebrew servant, the one you brought us to fondle me, tried to enter me. Listen well. I raised my voice. I screamed. And he left his coat beside me here when he ran outside." Now look, as his lord hears his wife's words, "This is the way I was handled by your servant," his anger bursts its bounds. Joseph's lord took hold of him, threw him into prison, the place where high prisoners of the king were held. I think that translation very clearly shows the narrative thread that Dr. J has been following here. The redactor, let me back up a bit. That story was written at the beginning of the reign of the House of Israel. Bloom believes that J was writing in the court of Solomon and was possibly a woman. In fact, he very strongly asserts that. But he does demonstrate that he has no strong evidence for it, just his feeling. Jay was writing at the beginning of a successful dynasty, the onset of the House of David. The redactor was just as clearly writing at the wreckage of that house's millennial reign. The idea is that the redactor brought all of these strands of narrative together after the return from the Babylonian captivity, over 1,000 years after Jay wrote. Trying to make sense of it, trying to prescribe for his or her people the life that would restore them to Yahweh's favor, now that they have been restored to his promised land and had restored to them the site of Solomon's temple. Bloom's commentary on that story, incidentally, supports again some of the things Bruce said. Joseph's rising career in the household of Potiphar is merely preamble to one of Jay's most delicious episodes, the attempted seduction of the charming son of Israel by Potiphar's lustful wife. Scholars have traced this story to an Egyptian romantic tale, yet it becomes great comic writing in Jay, comedy for its own sake, as well as another illustration that the Davidic, if outrageous, Joseph will always survive every scrape and emerge luckier than before. Part of Bloom's thesis is that Jay is using Joseph as an oblique remembrance of David, the king, who is dead. Solomon is reigning. Solomon, you'll recall, came to the kingship because Bathsheba, his mother, interceded with David. He's not the oldest of the sons, by any manner of means. Well, he's also not the youngest. If my surmise is correct that Jay established a tradition of absorbing the Joseph saga into the patriarchal histories in order to represent David covertly or obliquely, then the virtuous Joseph contrasts sharply with the erotically driven David. In any case, Jay shrewdly avoids making her Joseph a kind of religious prig. Instead, he declines Potiphar's wife on essentially pragmatic grounds, sensibly observing that everything except the lady has been vouchsafed to him with an authority equal to Potiphar's, except in regard to his temptress. So for Bloom, this is essentially a comedy, and I think that term describes both of these stories quite well. We don't retain that sense of the word comedy as much as we should. It's what Dante was referring to when he called his great work of theological poetry the comedy. We call it the divine comedy, but Dante was willing to let it be infernal and purgatorial as well as paradisical. All turns out well with Joseph. All turns out well with Corianton. Writing for a people in exile for 2 generations, the redactor gives us a tale of success in the story of Joseph, of Yahweh smiling on one of Jacob's tribe, but one who is not of the house of Judah and not, therefore, in the Davidic line. Yahweh's blessing is on the steward, the caretaker, the one who keeps his word, the one who does not violate the trust. That's the story of Joseph, who is chaste, who is pursued. Corianton's story, like his name, is more complex, got 4 syllables. He is the chaser, the pursuer, and Mormon gives us his story at great length, as he does Alma's, and I believe for the same reason. Mormon writes in the decadence of Lehite culture, or at least Nephite culture. In a truly precarious situation, the culture has gone beyond the precarious, and Moroni will ride in the post-carious shadow of a Nephite culture, which is not only incredibly long in the tooth, whatever few teeth are left, but has no more bite at all. But Mormon has seen enough to know what has rotted out the Nephite's civilization. Dr. J. again is right about Corianton's redemption. We last see him, still the traveler, gone forth to the land northward in a ship to carry forth provisions unto the people who had gone forth into that land. Perhaps he's still trying to undo the damage he'd caused 20 years earlier, which puts him at about 35 to 40. Again, writing at the end of the story, Mormon gives us the example of one who is exhorted to serve his community to heal its wounds rather than scrape them raw. In both stories, chastity is part of a larger relation of the individual, Joseph and Corianton, to his community. Joseph is a slave sold into Egypt. Judah of the southern kingdom has been enslaved in Babylon. Both can be saved only by their integration into a larger society and redeemed only by Yahweh. Corianton had attacked the only thing that ever seems to hold the Nephites together, and that's their religion. Let me repeat a part of the story here, because the story here that is told, as Bruce has pointed out, is not the story of Corianton, but it is an interesting story nonetheless. And now, my son, I have somewhat more to say unto thee than what I said unto thy brother. For behold, have ye not observed the steadiness of thy brother, his faithfulness, and his diligence in keeping the commandments of God? Behold, has he not set a good example for thee? That's the story. Two brothers. One of them who is not a good example, and one of them who is. And of course, we get a chapter on Shiblon, and we get four chapters on Corianton, the bad example. For thou didst not give so much heed unto my words as did thy brother among the people of the Zoramites. Now this is what I have against thee. And then he goes through the catalog that Bruce has already talked about. And then he concludes, Know ye not, my son, that these things are an abomination in the sight of the Lord, yea, most abominable above all sins, save it be the shedding of innocent blood or the denying of the Holy Ghost. For behold, if ye deny the Holy Ghost when it has once had place in you, and ye know that ye deny it, behold, this is a sin which is unpardonable. And then he goes on to talk a little more, and finally ends this story by saying, And I command you to take it upon you to counsel with your elder brothers in your undertakings. For behold, thou art in thy youth, and ye stand in need to be nourished by your brothers, and give heed to their counsel. It's not just the damage he has done to the Zoramites. Alma urges Corianton to weave himself back into the fabric of his people, starting with his family, starting with his brothers. I believe that Dr. J is right, that we're not looking at a clear-cut case of sexual sin. But we are looking very much at two stories in which temptation figures prominently and in which the temptation could serve to destroy the people, the entire people. Joseph manages to save his family because he has risen to a position of trust, and part of that trust is his ability to withstand the temptations placed before him in the courts of Egypt, or in the flesh pots of Egypt, if you will. Corianton fails that trust, although we don't know the exact specific nature of his sin. Corianton fails that trust. But then he manages to redeem himself by a return to the ministry, and finally at the end of his life, by continuing to minister to other people. Although he could be an entrepreneur with that shipload of food. Both Joseph and Corianton are younger brothers. Neither becomes the leader of his people. Joseph succeeds in an alien land where he's been sold into slavery through the blessing of Yahweh and his refusal of Potiphar's wife. Corianton succeeds only by returning to his people and trying to again bind them up. This is not a mission to the Lamanites that he's on. It's a mission to his own people who are following the tendency of destruction that they always seem to follow. As soon as they get a little bit righteous, they begin to pile up wealth. They begin to add to the lusts of their eyes the display of their fine twined linen and clothes. And by the time they reach the point of decadence where they're susceptible to attack from the Lamanites and can be destroyed, the only thing that can save them is a good solid rejection of all of that fine twine linen and all that gold and silver. I think that's what the two stories have in common, and I think that's why in both cases they are strong arguments for chastity, but certainly not limited to that. Okay, it looks like we have maybe three more minutes. I took longer than I'd thought. Go ahead.
If it's really going to be a chastity lesson, it seems to me there has to be some evidence that Joseph was genuinely empty.
Okay, the question.
I don't think I know what Potiphar's wife looked like. I don't know how old she was. And I'm not sure every young man would be tempted by any woman who asked him to lie with her.
Okay, the question is, was Joseph really tempted? Was Potiphar's wife desirable? Is any young man so randy that he'll lie with any woman who invites him?
I don't have an answer to that. I think that's a good point, and it's implicit in what I said. It's something I could add to what I've said. It isn't clear that Joseph feels any lust for her. He's shocked by what she proposes in terms of trust and property and status.
Her aggressiveness may make her very unattractive.
Yeah, he may be put off by that. I'm assuming that he's a virgin, though. There's no good reason to suppose that he'd have to be. Just given his father and his brothers and the whole pattern.
Come up and tell us.
There was gossip going around the household. So in her defense, she calls in all her women friends and gives them, I guess, apples or oranges or whatever it was, and a nice sharp knife. And then she has Joseph come in to wait on them, and every woman cuts her hand. This is the story in the Legends of the Jews. So,
I was trying to suggest, without going that far, you know, that there is the wife's side of the story, though I think that the J. Ryder pretty much gives us an Egyptian married pair who are hardly ideal. It's very hard to be sympathetic to the Potiphar's. A little more to the master, maybe, than to the wife. She's painted as a rather unsympathetic character, but I didn't want to risk speculating too well, though I know the rabbis love to do that. Any other? The Midrash, the whole Midrashic tradition, about which I know next to nothing. Thank you. You've endured a long time.